One evening, we were all on the quay before the king of the island in hope of news from the mainland. After handing out the letters, the king sat down in his heels and pulled out his pipe and tobacco, as was his habit. "The devil," he said, "it's my strong opinion we won't live much longer now. The two sides of the world are likely to burst against each other any moment." "Your soul to the devil. Who will buy the fish if there's a war? Who will buy the pig or the cow? Where will the buyers be found?" said Sean Fodder, spitting. "You may cut off the tip of my ear," said my grandfather, "if buyers were ever so prosperous as they will be at such a time." Some days later, the villagers were driving their cattle as usual onto the hill, and the first man to come in sight of the Bay of Dingle opened his eyes in wonder. Not an inch of the sea but was covered in white timber. Such a helter-skelter there was down the path to the quay. Curraghs, which had not stirred from the stays for 6 years, being thrown down to the water, and every man who had any strength in him with his hands on his oars. When I came home from school at midday, my sister Maura told me in great excitement that the south coast was full of wreckage. Out I ran and met Thomas Van Vaughan on the road. "Come south," I said breathlessly. We ran out to the point and opened our eyes in astonishment when we saw the sea. Wreckage of every sort. One curragh after another rounding the point, down to the gunwale with timber. We both leapt into the air with delight. At the point, there was not a child nor old woman in the village but were seated on their haunches on every stone looking out over the Bay of Dingle. I looked south to the skelligs and saw the curraghs making for home, full of wreckage. When they reached the quay, we all had great enjoyment dragging the timber up the slip. Next day, the quay and strands were a grand sight. "By God," one man would say, "war is good." "Other man," said another, "if it continues, this island will be the land of the young." The war changed people greatly. Idle loiterers who used to sleep it out till milking time were now abroad with the chirp of the sparrow, gathering and ever gathering. There was good living in the island now. Money was piled up. There was no spending. Nothing was bought. There was no need. It was to be had on the top of the water. Flour, meat, lard, petrol, wax, margarine, wine in plenty, even shoes, stockings, and clothes. Not a house in the island, but a storeroom was built beside it to keep the gatherings. Buyers were coming from all parts of Kerry so that money was being made rapidly. There's no doubt but a curragh can make a wonderful stand in a foamy sea. One Friday, the king of the island had gone to Dunquin for the post. "How is England doing, Porrick?" asked the Punkhorn when the letters had been given out.
"Ah, the divil," said the king. "It's likely the end of the world is coming, for they are making no stop now, and England is going to send out conscription through the whole of Ireland."
"Did you hear of a ship being sunk in any place since?" said another man.
"The divil," said the king. "One was sent down yesterday morning near Cork Harbour, the Lusitania, the finest ship the Americans ever had.
They say there were millionaires and plenty on board, and isn't it a terrible thing that not a sinner of them came ashore alive? If this breeze lasts from the touch tonight, the coast of the island will be full of drowned men tomorrow." No one went to sleep in the island that night. Many of them were out on the headlands, others up at cockcrow next morning in search of the millionaires. It was a Saturday and there was no school. As soon as I got up, I went down to the point. I sat on my heels and scanned every inch of the bay. After about a half an hour, I thought I noticed something far out to sea. I rubbed my eyes, thinking it might only be a fancy, but then I saw it again, and two seagulls settled on it. Certain of my opinion now, I ran home. "By God, Father," said I, "I've seen something, whatever it is." "Is that so?" said he, getting up. "Go south again and I'll call Mick," his brother. I darted back to the point. When I got there, I found Liam Tighe before me with the stoopin' and peering out to sea. "Is there any wreckage in the bay, Liam?" said I, mocking him.
Indeed, I think I see something between me and Slee Head. Look and see if you can make out what it is. By God, Liam, it is one of the millionaires. As sure as I live, said he, getting up. I walked up to the ditch and leaned back towards the village. With a glance down to the quay, I saw my father and uncle putting out in the curragh. When Liam saw them leaving the quay, "You rogue," said he, coming back to me, panting. "It's well you knew your father were going out after it." My father was near it now. "Faith," said Liam, "it is a human being." They had a tide now and were turning home. We stayed as we were till they came towards the point. Shortly afterwards, with a pull from the rope, the pale face turned towards us in the sunlight. We ran down the quay. It was a terrible sight, the eyes plucked out by the gulls, the face swollen and the clothes ready to burst with the swelling of the body. Later, at home, I saw a curragh making for the quay. "The peelers are come to the quay," I cried in excitement, and my father got up from the table. He went to speak with the sergeant. It was arranged to take the body to Dunquin so that the peelers could take care of it till its people would take it. When we reached Great Cliff, the body was taken out and stretched on the quay. The sergeant began searching the pockets, all of us looking on, but soon he drew back again. The stench was too strong. But there was one old man called Mick of the Hill standing beside us. He went down on his knees and began to open the coat. He put his hand in one of the pockets, and drawing out a small diary, he handed it to the sergeant. When he opened the book, the first thing I saw was the drowned man's name written like this: Henry Atkinson, 3 Edward Street, London, WC. First Class Officer, SS Lusitania. The next morning, I was sitting deep in thought when Tomas and Vaughan came running breathlessly towards me. "Easy, Tomas," said I. "Oh, Lord," he cried, "Sean Lane has a big boat full of sailors." I returned to the ditch and sat gazing steadily at the horizon. Before long, I saw the bow of a curragh beyond the spit and the men rowing hard. She was full of people. We ran down the quay, and the whole village was there. As the boat came into the pool, the first thing we noticed were some speaking English, others Italian, I don't know what. They leapt out onto the slip, 15 in all, some of them strong, others unable to stand. Then the last man to leave the boat spoke out and greeted the people in English. My father spoke to him. "I suppose you are the captain?" "I am not, but the mate. I'll tell you what happened to the captain." Everyone gathered around. "We left Buenos Aires, bound for Cork. When we were about 20 miles southwest of Chirac, we met a submarine. It drew up alongside. The captain spoke, ordering us to take to the boats as he was going to sink the ship. 5 boats we had, and we got them out as fast as we could. Then the torpedo struck the ship, and we saw her going down by the stern. Well, my good people, we are on the sea ever since, for the weather was bad, and what was worse, we were scattered like the sons of Lear. Oh, it was a terrible destruction," he cried with tears in his eyes. "I had 3 brothers in the other boats, and no tale nor tidings of them since." "Ah, they're safe at the help of God," said my father. "Have no fear for them." "Indeed, I don't know," he said. "But with regard to the captain, there's no doubt he was a bad one. We had no food in the boat but biscuits. He was giving us only 1 biscuit a day and no water at all. The crew rose against him. They told him 3 times if he didn't give every man his due, they would throw him overboard. And then that big dark fellow over there got thirsty and asked the captain for a drink. The captain refused, and the fellow leapt from the bows and caught him by the throat and threw him into the sea." When the mate had finished his story, the sailors were brought up into the village and got what attention it was in the power of the islanders to give them.
In 3 hours, when they were all washed, clean and shaved, with an hour's sleep, you'd think they were not the same men. We went down to the quay, for the sailors were going down to Dunquin. I was standing at the top beside Sean Michael and old Mickle. They walked down the slip and all went into the boat, except one, who was still out in the slip, shouting and roaring, though none of us could understand him. "Oh, Lord," said one man, "maybe he's going off his head. God between us and evil." He was leaping in anger. "The devil, my lad," said old Mickle, "if that man below is not tied, he'll make corpses." There was a laugh here and there. When he heard the laughter, he rushed up to us in a poisonous haste, chattering fiercely. He pointed with his finger to the top of the village. "Saka! Saka! Saka!" And then a long rush of talk. Then he ran up as fast as he could to the village. Everyone now thought he was out of his wits. We watched him running till he went into the house of Liam Tigh, and the next minute he was out again, with a bag in his hand. "Your sword to the devil," said Sean Michael. "It's the bag. He left it behind him." "You're right," said Sean Lane. "That was the sack he was seeking." He ran down the path. Then turning towards us, he cried, so it seemed to me, "Gurlamacarus, Gurlamacarus." "Safe journey to you," answered old Mickle. "Gurlamacarus," said he again with a smile. "The devil, my lad," said Mickle. "It wasn't Gurlamacarus with you just now when you had forgotten your bag." He leapt aboard. The boat moved out through the pool, the men waving their handkerchiefs till they were out of sight.
"20 Years A-Growing" by Maurice O'Sullivan was read by P.G. Stevens, abridged by Anne Rhys-Jones, and produced by Maurice Leach.